One of the signature actors of his generation, Terrence Stamp, has played everything from a hitman to a transgendered woman, as well as an alien warlord. He writes about his career and his spiritual journey in a new memoir for Repeater Books called The Ocean Fell Into the Drop. Mr. Stamp has recently the subject of a 15-movie retrospect at the Metrograph Theater, and tonight he'll be taking questions there after the 7 p.m. screening of The Hit, and we are honored he could come by and join us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
So first, can you explain the meaning of the title, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop?
Well, during my kind of long association with Krishnamurti, I was always, I guess, a little bit intimidated by him, by his presence. And after I'd known him on and off for about 10 years, in fact, it was like near the end of his life, I finally said to him, listen, you know, we've known each other a long time. How do you explain what happened to you the night that it happened? And he said, the ocean fell into the drop. And it wasn't my title. I mean, I had some other title. And the woman who was typing it for me said, this should be your title.
Right.
So that's how it came about.
Right. What prompted you to write this memoir?
What prompted me to write the memoir really was that I got into the habit of going into a sort of unique bookshop in London, and unbeknownst to me, the owner heard about it, and he asked, you know, could he meet me, and he came round to talk to me, and he said to me, have you thought about writing another memoir? And I said, no. And he said, well, would you think about it? And the truth was that I don't know how it is for what I think was proper writers, but I never felt particularly positive about at the beginning of starting to scribble something, you know?
Right.
And this time, the more he talked about it, the better I felt. And I didn't really answer because I was taken aback by how positive I was feeling. Then he kept talking about it, and he was kind of giving me ideas, really. And fact was that, you know, when he left, I just picked up a pencil and I started scribbling on the back of a screenplay, which is how I write all my stuff. And it just kind of fell out of my hand, really. It only took about 3 or 4 weeks to write, you know.
And so you still compose longhand?
Yes.
What is it that you think you gain from that experience, or what is it that's sort of rich about that experience for you, writing out in longhand?
Well, I've never thought about it, really. It's just that I can't type, so if I want to write,
default.
That's how I do it.
So 30 years ago, you wrote the autobiography Stamp Album. Was that a very different experience for you?
Yes, because my mum had passed away and I was shooting a movie abroad and I couldn't get home for the funeral. And I missed her terribly because she was like the main kind of force in my life, you know, because I was born at the beginning of the war and my dad wasn't there and my mother kind of was responsible for all my early years, really. And so with the kind of grief came all the memories of her, things that I'd never thought about for years. So I just kind of started writing them down. It was a way of kind of easing the sadness, really. And a woman who was an English woman, very pushy woman, came to have tea with me in my place and picked up my scribbling.
Right.
And said, I'm going to take this and get it typed. I said, but it's not, no, she wouldn't have it. She took it, she got it typed. And without my permission, she gave it to a wonderful editor called Liz Calder, who just started a new publishing company called Bloomsbury.
Right.
And I got this call from Liz Calder, and she said, we want to publish your memoir. And I said, but it's not a memoir, it's just, no, I don't care. And they just published it as it was, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was only when it was, I mean, it was well received, but the fact that it was taken seriously was sufficient of an incentive for me to carry on, you know.
Yeah. Well, and so it sounds like your point of origin as a writer had a very sort of cathartic nature to it,
indeed.
Right? The death of your mother.
Indeed.
Have you carried, is that still sort of the process, part of the process for you now as a writer, sort of a sense of catharsis, examination of your life?
It's not something, if I'm honest with you, I don't really feel that I have any kind of talent as a writer. So consequently, I only really scribble when the mood takes me. You know, it's a kind of it's similar to my life as a performer, but it's a different feeling, because with the feeling as a performer, it's just very often when I'm doing well, it's just before action. There's a kind of a series of feelings that I get that's just there between action and cut. So obviously it's not like that with writing, but it's similar in the sense that it's a slightly altered state. And whilst it's me, I just don't feel that I can take claim of it. So it's not something that I can feel confident about. You know, if you said to me, oh, could you knock us out 1,000 words on this? I just couldn't do it.
Right.
Because it's not like that.
Right. Well, so 30 years between Stamp Album and The Ocean Fell Into the Drop. Are you a different person now?
Yeah.
How so?
I guess my kind of awareness has really increased, you know. I'm kind of, I guess about 10, 15 years ago, I started becoming aware when I was absent.
Hmm.
And that kind of increased my awareness.
In your daily life, in your daily experiences.
In my everyday life. And then that had a kind of a knock-on effect into when I was asleep. So in other words, during the dream state, there was also a kind of shift in the quality of the dreams, but the fact that they were very clear when I woke up. So I guess there's a fundamental change in I guess what is looking is more present.
Right.
That doesn't sound too pretentious.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Terrence Stamp about his memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop. You know, you've had so many amazing encounters, ones I never would have expected given the types of roles you played. For instance, you write about being inspired by Cheetah Rivera.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was at drama school. And miraculously, I had won a scholarship to go to drama school because, you know, I was from a very poor family. And
how did you win the scholarship?
I auditioned for all the big drama schools. And RADA and the London Academy, none of them had scholarships. So I wound up going to auditioning at a much smaller academy, which was called the Webber Douglas Academy. And I remember doing my classical piece was from Othello, and I was offered this scholarship. But apart from having a free tuition, they gave me money. But the money they gave me would, in today's money, would be about $10 a week. You know? Mm-hmm. So that's all I had to live on. So when I got to drama school, I was really going hungry most of the time. And I wound up getting a showman's job at West Side Story. It had just opened in London at Her Majesty's Theatre. And I just went along there and I hung out outside the stage door. And one of the stage doormen took pity on me, said, "They want somebody in the lime box. Can you manage a lime?" And I didn't know what a lime was, but I said, "Sure, sure." So I wound up doing in fact, it was a follow spot, you know. Right. So I wound up with all my cues on the wall and I wound up doing a follow spot. So I saw her. I couldn't do the midweek matinee because I was at school.
Yeah.
But I did two shows on Saturday and I did every other show. And that was how I met her. I met her backstage, you know.
And you got the experience to, on a regular basis, see how she connected with the live audiences and the variances there, right?
Yeah. And she was kind of like, so my life, the first person I ever saw who made a huge impact on me was Gary Cooper. That was the first movie I ever saw. And so he had something that was kind of just stopped my thought process. You know, he had an impact on me. I'd never seen anybody like that, with that kind of presence. And consequently, I was aiming very high. And I think that Cheetah Rivera was the first woman I saw in life that had that same kind of a heart-stopping presence, you know. She was a great, great performer, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned Cooper. You open the book with an episode of seeing him when you were very young, yes.
Yeah, it was the first movie I ever saw, you know.
And so is that when you knew you first wanted to be an actor?
Well, but I guess something in me knew, but I never thought about it like that. I just thought that I loved him. And I wanted to go and see his movies, and I became an avid moviegoer. But it wasn't until I actually, because it wasn't anything that I could even talk about at home. It was just out of the question.
Why?
Because it was like, it wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my dad was a stoker in the Navy.
It was too far flung.
It was just silly, you know, to have talked about it. But I was, the funny thing was that I was aware of that. I was aware how outrageous. So it was kind of my secret. And the way I kept it alive was by keeping it a secret. And it was only when I left school and I went to work and I thought, I can't live my life doing this. I got to try that. So I guess, yes.
I'm D.W. Gibson. I'm speaking with Terrence Stamp about his memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop. You won an Academy Award nomination for your film debut in the title role of Billy Budd. Did that give you a greater sense of freedom in choosing your subsequent roles?
No, not really, because I was kind of, I was nominated in the supporting actor category, so I knew it was like a fix. I thought I wasn't a supporting actor, I was the title role, you know. I was kind of was a bit offended by that, you know. But the truth was that it did get me noticed, and so I was from that moment I was always very choosy. I always chose things that I thought would interest me as a performer. I was interested in becoming multidimensional, you know.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Terrence Stamp about his new memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop. I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Terrence Stamp about his memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop, published by Repeater Books. In your book, Terrence, you single out the cinematographers of your films. What was your relationship like to artists like Robert Krasker and Robert Surdes?
Just wonderful, really, because it was a completely new thing for me, you know. So I didn't know. I realized they were very highly regarded within the crew, but I didn't realize that they were kind of responsible for like how I looked. And so I was very, very lucky in the sense that, you know, Krasker, who'd lit The Third Man, was like probably the greatest black and white cinematographer in the world at the time. And then when I went to, when I came to California for the first time and I was working with William Wyler, I had the great Surtees, you know, and consequently, I was kind of spoilt by those guys, but they made me aware of like how critical my movement inside the frame was, you know. So I kind of developed, I was feeling these very deep emotions from time to time, but there was a kind of discipline about staying within the frame, because I was conscious of how much trouble they'd gone to, you.
I think that's one of the things that might be lost on so many moviegoers, that sort of tight space that an actor works in within a scene physically, in terms of the limitations on how one might move one's, not only body, but even face and eyes, yes?
Yeah, and what's tricky is that, I think either you can do it, or you have it, or you don't, because the... You know, when you're working, when you're between action and cut, the ocean does sometimes fall into the drop. You know what I mean?
Right.
and the drop is defined by don't move closer.
Quarter of an inch.
Yes, exactly.
So, and you mentioned Wyler. You worked with so many important directors: Fellini, Pasolini, Schlesinger, Joseph Losey. Can you gauge their impact on your acting?
Yes, I think the very first one was Peter Ustinov, who was like, you know, like a great genius, you know what I mean? He's not really thought of as a great director, but he was a great director for me.
Hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, he just knew how to, because he was so sensitive that he was able to direct me with, you know, a sensitivity that I would probably not have comprehended if it hadn't have come from such a great man himself, you know. So he kind of put me on the right track. And then, you know, for my second important movie, I got William Wyler, who was just probably one of the greatest directors that ever lived, you know. So he was kind of, he was unusually sensitive. And the thing I remember about Wyler was that, I had turned down the part for three or four times for the producer. And finally he called me and said, "We've got William Wyler, are you gonna turn down William Wyler?" And I said, "Who are the girls?" And he said, "Well, we're testing girls." And I said, "Well, I'd like to do the tests, because I didn't think I could get anywhere near the character, do you see, as written from the John Fowles novel."
Right.
So I tested with the girls, and Wyler didn't direct the tests, but Wyler flew over to see the tests, and he asked to see me. And I just remember this kind of diminutive guy coming out of an office in Columbia and walking down this long hallway, just looking at me. And he got really close to me. And I said, "What?" And he said, and he just nodded, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Do you want me for this?" And he nodded again. And I said, "But in the book." And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "I'm not going to make the book."
Mm. Make a movie.
So that was William Wyler, you know, right? What I mean? Not every young actor gets to work with a guy like that, you know.
Right. Well, of course, you know sort of your approach to acting, your style. Isn't it so often about communication between you and the director and finding a way to sort of channel your creative impulses?
It's only about that. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the first thing is that. Yeah. That's really the first thing.
So a lot of the book is occurring during the height of the Rock Rebellion in London. You roomed briefly with Michael Caine, and he's on record as saying the best parties in London were thrown by your brother, Chris Stamp. Can you vouch for this?
I'm sure it's true. I don't remember, frankly.
Well, I was going to ask you to paint us a picture, but I suppose that's out of the question then. How involved were you with those figures, the Who, the Rolling Stone, the Beatles?
Not really. I met Townsend and I knew the Who but the only real people I became kind of close with was Jim Morrison and the Doors, and I became rather friendly with John Lennon. You know, but other than that, our worlds didn't come together very much, you know.
Right. Well, reading your memoir is rather surreal. For the most amazing people, you know, they pop up in the random moments, like Muhammad Ali. Tell us about that story.
Well, he was just a guy. Well, first of all, I had gone to see him. It was the first live fight I'd ever seen. When he came to London and he fought Henry Cooper, you know, mm-hmm. And he took a heavy punch from Cooper. It was a very long time in the corner, you know, and we all thought that he'd nailed him, you know. And then many, many years later, this guy came up to me, sort of shuffled up to me in the air, looked at me, and I was looking at him, and he came up to me and he said, "You're a great actor." And I said, "I'm not as great an actor as you are a fighter, you know." And he shook hands with me, and I think the thing that really impressed me was that how beautiful his hands were, how long the fingers were, and how delicate and fine the skin was, you know. And I thought, my God, that guy, you know, he's one of the toughest fighters ever lived, you know, and he's an artist, you know, right. He's got this artist's hands, you know.
I suppose the butterfly part of his persona was found in his hands.
Absolutely. I touch that.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Terrence Stamp about his memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop, published by Repeater Books. Tell us about Orson Welles. How did you meet him?
I met him very, very late in his career. And he had a movie that he was writing, and he kind of wanted to meet me about it. And I flew to Paris to see him. And I just had an evening with him. And it was something kind of, I guess what struck me about him initially was that he never really sort of stretched me. He never kind of let on the depth of his own personality. But when I moved the subject in a certain area, he was right there with me. So it was a really delicate, like a great intelligence, but a very sensitive way in which he handled the world, you know. And it was just one of the most wonderful moments in my life, really. And of course, yeah, he couldn't get the money, so it was just one evening.
It sounds like he still had a generosity of spirit. Sometimes when people are sort of further along in their career, they might sort of lose some of the generosity they might have had earlier, but it sounds like he had it that night.
I think the thing that I've found in common with you know, the great artists that I have met was the same with Fellini, was the same with Wyler, is that they just... they're completely with you, and they're never indelicate. They wait for you to reveal yourself before they reveal a little more of themselves. And I think I associate that with really sensitive artists. I think it's something that's quite rare these days.
Well, you already mentioned Krishnamurti. You write about meeting him in Rome. Did you have any idea who he was at the time when you met him?
No.
No.
And in fact, it was a very unusual kind of experience because I was working with Fellini because O'Toole had turned him down, and Fellini had called a casting director in London and said, "Send me your most decadent actors," you know. An actor called James Fox and I went, and my dyed blonde hair was growing out from a western I'd made, and got off the plane, and Fellini was there at the airport, and it was kind of love, you know. And unbeknownst to me, he was trying to get the money for his masterpiece, which is called The Voyage of Mastorna. And it was about, the premise of the story was that it's after the main character is dead, and he was writing it for Marcello Mastroianni. And he wanted to check out his screenplay, and he knew this Italian socialite called Contessa Wanda Scaravelli, and he knew she knew this guy called Krishnamurti. And he asked her if he could meet Krishnamurti, and she arranged it. And Fellini, being Fellini, showed Krishnamurti a rough cut of the movie that I was making with him. And I think, much to Krishnamurti's Fellini's disappointment, after he saw it, Krishnamurti said, "I'd like to meet that boy." So I was consequently invited to a lunch of Contessa Wanda, and there he was, this little man, you know.
Yeah.
Little is the wrong word to describe.
Yeah, I was going to say this little big man, of course.
Yes.
Well, and you've worked with so many actors over the years. You worked with Marlon Brando. What was that like?
It was heaven, really. I think he was probably one of the most fun performers I've ever worked with. He was just exquisite, you know. And I hadn't worked for about 7 or 8 years. I was living in an ashram in Pune when the inquiry came to come back to see Richard Donner about Superman 1 and 2. So when I was on the set the first day, I was still in my orange clothes, my orange cardi outfit, and I saw Marlon with these two very beautiful women. They were all sort of, they were giggling, and he was looking at me, and they were giggling, and he finally came over to me. He said, "Hi, I'm Marlon." I said, "Nice to meet you, Marlon." I said, "What's up with those?" And he said, so that was my first line from Marlon. So you can imagine what a fun shoot that was.
I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Terrence Stamp about his memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop. I have to imagine that was quite a transition, going from ashram in Pune to a major Hollywood film. I mean, what was that transition like for you?
I think the transition was that my realization came that I was kind of no longer like a leading man. I could no longer kind of pick and choose. So in my mind, it wasn't the first real character I'd played, but it was the first character I'd played as a character actor, like thinking of myself as a character actor.
Right.
So as that happened, I kind of came in contact with a kind of new strata of my performing self, as it were.
Can you talk about The Hit a little bit, where you're after the screening at the Metrograph, you'll be doing a Q&A and signing your memoir. What really stands out to you about the experience of making that film?
I think what stands out about it was two things, really. It was how delicate it was to work with Stephen Frears.
His directorial debut, right?
Yeah. But also how wonderful it was to kind of interact with John Hurt, because I know that at the time John Hurt was considered like a difficult guy to work with, you know, because he liked to a drink, you know. But the fact was that it was so, was just so wonderful to interact with him. There's certain actors that when you get, when you're in front of the camera and you're between action and cut, there's a kind of coming together of the talents, and it's kind of two and two make five, you know, and that was one of those occasions when that happened with John Hurt and I.
Well, in recent years, you've been rediscovered by a new generation of filmmakers. You played opposite comedian Jim Carrey in Yes Man, and then there was Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, where you returned to a lead role. What was it like making that film?
Didn't quite believe it, you know. He was very kind of unsure about telling me, like, what he was intending to do with the old footage, you know. And I said, why have you got these doubts? You know what I mean? Like, why are you asking me if it's okay? You know. And he said, well, it's. It's not every actor who wants to be up there with himself 30 years previous. And I said, not me, mate, not me.
Well, and recently you've been working with Tim Burton. What have the two of you been doing together?
Well, we've been doing a kind of a movie that I didn't really think too much about. But he was just... Yeah, it's hard to explain how wonderful some of these directors are, you know, when you meet them for the first time. And it just gels. You feel as though you've known each other forever, you know. And that was how it was with Tim Burton, you know. It was a real trip working with him, frankly.
Nice. Well, it's positively overwhelming the amount of films that you've been in, the variety of films, and it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to revisit some of them with a retrospective. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with Terrence Stamp about his new memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop. Tonight at 7, The Hit will be screening at the Metrograph, followed by a conversation with Terrence Stamp and a signing of his memoir, The Ocean Fell Into the Drop.